Now, oh, there, look at that. It's going way up. Okay.
Okay, I think it's
working. All right. Hopefully. Now we're going to have an interview with Professor Douglas Furstenow. Okay.
The bellhop took us up to the room with the luggage, and Lincoln reached in his pocket and said, told me, says, "I got 8 cents. And I reached in my pocket. I said, "I got a nickel." He said, "Well, give it to me."
Uh-huh.
And so the 13 cents, you know, he had in his hand, and the bellhop opened his hand and said, "Thank you," and didn't look at it, but he obviously glanced at it as he put it in his pocket. And he said, "Well, I'll be goddamned," and walked out. All the money we had.
Oh.
I thought we had, you know, a dollar or two or something, sure. But not much more. But well, you're not going to give a 1947 bellhop a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
That was that was the beginning of our stay, and that Sunday afternoon when we. Bob Lincoln and I were walking out. He graduated Rhapsody High School the year before me. And we were walking along just on the street in Chicago, downtown in the Loop, and ran into, there's no one else on the street, but a classmate of his that I knew also, Fred Frankel, right on the...
What was the name?
Fred Frankel. That's, you know, the rarity of running into somebody from your hometown
from South Dakota.
From South Dakota on the Loop on an occasion. This sort of struck, and never had that happen again. But then we moved on into sort of getting settled into the work. But that was the beginning. So anyway, got back to South Dakota, and then I started taking physical chemistry. I didn't like the lab, and I decided that's what made me switch to metallurgy.
Hmm.
The metallurgy didn't need the lab, and I was so unhappy with the lab. For somebody who's had a lot of lab experience in physical chemistry since, that's a little odd. But anyway, I decided on the spur of the moment to switch over to metallurgy, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
And, the main metallurgy professor had been there for decades, was Bancroft Gore, who you may have known, and your father obviously knew.
Certainly
well.
Heard the name a
yeah,
lot.
Yeah, yeah. And anyway, he died, because he... in the fall, as I remember, then they got two new metallurgy professors that came in. One I used to talk to a lot named Alex McHugh. Who was kind of an old farmer, but really I got to like him as time went by. And the other one who was in the physical metallurgy side, I can't think of his name, I'll fill it in.
You get it, sure.
Because I really got interested in processing. In that year, the mineral processing course was taught by, because Gore had died, Dr. Lincoln, who was the mining professor, whose son I'd worked with the previous summer. He was already obviously approaching retirement age, and he lectured a lot about ancient methods of processing ores, and you know, you've probably seen these things called arastras, that are stones that were dragged around by a mule. They were, think, used in Mexico and Chile, and I've seen them in Arizona, and I still recall him drawing an arrastra, drawing a mule, and he stepped back and he looked at the mule and he erased it and drew it a different size. He told us, he really dated back, and he told us about, how you get a mule down a mine. Of course, they had mules down in the home state, but I guess, you put them in a cage and turn the cage on end, and then they can't kick, and so it's the best way to get them in the mine. He died then, that year, at the end of that year, too. But I took, geology courses, mineralogy, and extra chemistry. As a sophomore, I took organic chemistry, and there was a professor named Carl Schultz that I thought was very, four or five times he took three, four of us on a Saturday trip. I remember going up to Deadwood, and one of them had come from Deadwood. We went into an old abandoned mine where ferrous sulfate, which is something I think called melanthonite, made stalactites and stalagmites dripping, iron from, I suppose, a oxidizing pyrite, and it's a iron sulfate with water in it, in the molecule, just look like stalagmites and stalactites. And we take them out, and then the water eventually evaporates, and then they crumble. Mm-hmm. We panned gold, went out to the Badlands, things like that,
good learning.
I have no idea what his interest in doing that with three, four of us, at least four or five times. This was an interesting...
dedicated teacher.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This was not related to the chemistry.
No.
But yeah. This was...
His own time.
On his own time, and so on. And then I also had chemistry from John Willard, who I interacted with quite a bit through the years, and Willard was one of these persons always working on something. And one time I saw on 60 Minutes some years back about Willard's water. Did you ever read anything in the local paper? Apparently he did something with water, and I know almost zero about it, but treated it with either peat or some darn thing like that. But anyway, this water was very good at cleaning metal and things like that. And they peddled this stuff as Willard's water, and it made maybe charcoal was involved. I have no idea, but it did make 60 Minutes about Willard's water, and what and they were selling this stuff, and somebody.
Wasn't a hoax.
Oh, I think it was a hoax.
Oh,
they didn't think it was a hoax.
I see.
No, they were believers.
I see.
But this Willard's water didn't exist back in my day.
No.
I saw things in the paper about it. Never did ask anybody from South Dakota, what in the world Willard's water was, but he taught chemistry there through his entire time, but I did take mineralogy, geology courses. Like mineralogy, there's a very great teacher there named John Paul Greece. And Greece still alive, and my brothers had a lot of interaction with Greece. And I think he came in 1936 after finishing his PhD in the University of Chicago, was there the whole time, and I think lived in Rapid City until just maybe a year ago, and now moved to his son, because I think his wife died not long ago. And then last time I saw him, he had to be obviously late 80s and still looking almost the same and still, you know, with it. And he'd just written a book or put together a book called South Dakota Geology Along the Highway. There's apparently books from a lot of states where you drive along the road, all the roads, and and this is the geology that you see, road cuts and so on. So I bought that book just very few years ago.
Wow.
And he was very inspiring. I liked him and have ever since. So then I'm assuming most of that year was sort of uneventful, but I worked again in the summer. And
at U.S. Steel?
This was again at U.S. Steel, and even though I had destroyed many ingots of stainless steel, they hired me back, and this time I was in the open hearths, and the open hearth is where you make the steel. The pig iron comes out of the blast furnace at something like 6% carbon, and it's got the manganese and a lot of silicon in it, phosphorus in it. You got to get it out of there. And so the way to do it is, in those days, was these large furnaces that might.
I'm sorry. Did you say silicon?
Silicon. Yeah. Si. Silicon. Yeah. Silicon and carbon and phosphorus are the ones that. And so. Well, these furnaces must be 80 feet by 20 feet in plan view, and they're charged with scrap, and then as the scrap is heated, it's oxidized, it makes iron oxide, and then you pour in the pig iron, right? You've seen pictures of the ladles with pig iron, and
what's the fuel?
Fuel would be coke, and maybe oil fired, and also, they'd be oil fired. Come to think of it, I think it was most of them. There might, and they on the two sides, and as that came across, it would oxidize the. As the burnt CO came across, it would oxidize the iron to iron oxide. Okay, so then they added limestone. And so now the metallurgical observer had to calculate out what would be all the things to add to the furnace. Mm-hmm. You know, how much lime, how much, limestone would be one of the big ones that I remember. But you would calculate out what charge would be, how much scrap, and so on, because each heat of steel had its destination. I remember it said car fenders, beer can ends, springs, spring steel, you know, because they had to have a certain composition. And so these heats would be in the open hearth up to 10, 12 hours maybe, and you'd have to take temperature and record the height of the slag and whether it's foaming or not, because if bubbling off the carbon being oxidized would bubble off CO and CO2, and you know, that would make the thing foam, and all this had to be watched, because, and then when
I suppose all that is mechanized, automated now?
Well, they've gone to different methods, smaller often electric furnaces and scrap with a, you know, I kind of haven't paid attention very much, but I don't think open hearts are probably used anywhere in this country anymore. But anyway, that was the way of making steel. Mm-hmm. The other one was Bessemer steel, where they actually blew oxygen through that would then burn out, and that's what often lit up the sky that I told you about. Mm-hmm. But anyway, then the thing was, when the furnace was then tapped, it was tapped into these huge ladles, and then the observer had to go down and you would take the temperature of the steel as it's coming out of the ladle into these big ingots.
And how did you do that?
Or with an optical pyrometer.
You weren't sticking a thermometer.
No, it's optical. You match the red brightness with an element or film in the instrument, so you got the brightness to be the same that's in the instrument, the color to be the same as with the color of the steel, and the whole thing being calibrated would give you the exact temperature. Now, optical pyrometer is one way to make high temperature measurements.
Okay.
Now, you've seen red hot steel, you know, like take an electric stove burner.
Right.
Okay, well, this would be, the brighter it gets, it, you know, it gets orange, yellow, and almost white as it gets hotter.
Did you wear goggles of some kind?
Well, you had to wear goggles, and you had to wear these really heavy wool, and I mean heavy wool suits in this.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ambient temperature some days was 140 degrees inside those, in the steel mills. And I remember the room where you, where everyone's desk was air conditioned at 85 degrees, and it felt like going into a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
At 85, on the outside, it's 130. I haven't stretched it, 130, 140. So you had to then take the temperature, and there might be 20 of these ingots that would be 2 feet by 2 feet, or 2 feet by 3 feet, some 2 feet by 4 feet, maybe 8 feet high. I mean, these are big. And so, depending on, and then alloys may be added as they are pouring.
Mm-hmm.
Some alloys might have been added in the open hearth, but a lot of them are added in the ladle. And maybe all of this you had to write down and make sure was done and tell the people doing it. And then some steel, it's bubbling air bubbles out, or CO. And CO and CO2 is foaming like a Coca-Cola, and they throw aluminum shot into it to kill it, and that's called killed steel. And then and it depends on what the steel is going to be used for as to whether you want it to be free of bubbles or have the bubbles there. And of course, what would happen is the aluminum would react immediately with the CO and deoxidize and get rid of all the gas that way. So that's what I did that whole summer, was in those in the open heart. Again, it's a fair amount of responsibility, and at that time they were doing some research on what they called basic Bessemer, which I think that's what basically replaced the open hearth, and there was a sort of senior meddler just working. We're talking about full scale, but they were running this is 1948. So that was a, you know, summer job of great interest and responsibility and so on. I have no recollection at all of who was in charge of the observers that summer. I do know the one in the rolling mill used to come around almost daily, but I just don't recall. Again, this was shift work. Mm-hmm. And
did you stay with Mrs. Croker again?
I did. Yeah, I did. And that summer there were two of us. Sam Adel, A-D-E-L. And by the way, he told me, Sam Adler. Adler. And he told me every time there was a Jewish holiday in the Army, they gave him the day off because they thought he was Jewish.
And he wasn't.
Adler is the German word for nobility, or is it for eagle? I have to look it up, but it's one or the other. And anyway, he said when he was in the Army, they always gave him the Jewish holiday.
He never complained.
He didn't complain, but he took what was what they gave him, but he said he wasn't Jewish. But he was a physics major there in South Dakota. Never seen him, after we graduated. But he had this worked somewhere there in the same steel mills
Do you go dancing again?
Without a doubt. it's funny, I got, which I'll talk to you a little later about, I later got very, very interested in baseball. And I never went to a single baseball game during those summers. And that really surprises me, given how much I used to do. I was just at 47, just the beginning of television, and once in a while I would watch it in a bar or something. They'd have TV, mm-hmm. and they would have the ball games on. But it's funny, I often went to on day off on a Saturday to downtown movies that had entertainment. These are these sort of fancy movie places that would have a movie and then maybe a 45-minute show in between. I remember the Harmonicats, were there for one of them, and then went to a couple of musicals, one of the main ones that were picked over. Then, like Oklahoma and so on. Mm-hmm. I did that on my own, but on a Saturday, because it was a long ride from 125th South up to the Loop.
You mentioned museums earlier.
Well, Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago is a tremendous place, and they even had a mine in there.
Really?
And I went there, several times, and then there's another one called the Field Museum.
Natural History.
That's what Natural History. And then Art Institute is their art museums. Funny name for it. But
they're all fairly near each other.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. And that first week or so, a year earlier, where we lived at 59th and Harper, that was about two blocks from the Museum of Science and Industry. That's 59th. The others, they're all along the lake there, as you know. Remember one time, which may have been 47 or 48, was a major anniversary of the Chicago Tribune, and they had their owner was named McCormick, and they had the biggest fireworks display I ever saw down there along the lake. The show shows. I think fireworks went up that had the whole American flag as it broke.
Mm.
Things like that, all in celebration, either of the Chicago Tribune or McCormick's 75th birthday or 50th anniversary or something.
Some big thing,
right? So I used to, spend my not waste time, but go do things.
Took advantage of what Chicago offered.
Right, why not, right?
Did you ever take the train to Chicago?
The second year, went on the train from, I went to Mobridge and then stayed with, you know, some old friends for a couple days, and then went by train, Milwaukee Road to Chicago. When I got on the train in Mobridge, somebody sitting right in front of me or behind me were two guys from New York who had just been freshmen at Montana School of Mines, and this one was named Herb Drexler, a very talkative soul, Drexler, and we talked quite a bit, and you know, he was still maybe he was a senior at Montana School of Mines the year I went there as a grad student, and I had seen him on and off through the years. Somebody eventually did a PhD in mineral economics from Columbia, and I think was the last I knew was Professor University of British Columbia. But here was this talkative guy that's sitting in the seat either in front or behind me. When I got on in Mobridge, they were coming from Butte, going all the way to New York on the train. The one thing I remember was, now these were steam engines, and going from Milwaukee to Chicago, timed the train, and you know that steam engine was going about 100 miles an hour. You know, they really could go, with speed. You know, diesels eventually replaced all the steam, but the steam engine, as far as speed goes, you know, it was possible for them to do that.
Dirty.
Oh yeah. But inside it was okay. And I have no recollection on the return, but I probably came back by train to...
Rapid City had several passenger trains at that time.
You know, I now know how I got back. I think I went, got off at a place called Milbank in South Dakota, hitchhiked to Watertown, and stayed, a couple days with my grandmother, then a few days down on the farm on thrashing time, and then went by car to Huron, where the state fair was. You ever go to the state fair in South Dakota?
Sorry, I missed that.
That whole day must at the wonderful state fair, and then took the train to Rapid City. And you know, that train took all night, and I think it averaged about 25 miles an hour if it were moving. And I think it was a Northwestern, wasn't it?
Well, there was Burlington and Northwestern.
Okay, anyway, went from Huron Pier. Or Huron, maybe not Pier, but Chamberlain, maybe where it crossed. And then to Rapid City, right?
Mm-hmm. Stopped for meals.
And didn't move very fast. You probably took that on your trips east.
Yeah.
They
didn't have a dining car. They stopped for meals.
Was that right? Okay,
now,
I just
maybe by 49.
Well, yeah, but I got on in the late evening and went all night.
I think they stopped at places like Kadoka for lunch, dinner,
right?
Or something. It was quite an adventure.
Yeah, I forgot. We couldn't go very fast that's how I. And I now know that's how I got back. And I remember, hitchhiking from to.
And that was safe.
And I was probably a clean-looking guy.
So those were learning experiences.
Oh yeah, right. So then that was now the fall of 48, and
you were beginning your third year then in college.
Fourth.
Well, let's see. Two summers.
48, 49. I graduated 49, so I was now beginning my senior year.
You went through in 3 years?
4 years.
Well, let's see.
I went to summer school a bit in 46. I went to summer school. I don't know what it took, and I worked in a part time in the chemistry storeroom for Doc Willard was teaching some class, and so I must have. Oh, I remember taking a speech class in the summer, so there must I must have been making up something.
Was at the end of your second year that you went to Chicago the first
and the
time?
End of the second, end of the
and
third.
And the third, so then you're coming back for your fourth.
Yeah, I must have had a, and going clear back a little bit, I took this speech course, and the one thing, the only thing I remember of that other than the teacher, who was somebody who was a PhD in English, but was an All-America football player from UCLA. You know, it must have been somebody said he had a silver plate in his head, so he must have got. But anyway, he taught English.
Do you remember his name?
I'll look it up. Hyman was I think his first name, but anyway, he taught this speech course. We were only supposed to, you know, so many minutes was supposed to be each talk, and I think I gave a talk on rocketry and what it would take to go to the moon and stuff like that. But the one part I remember was one of my classmates, older than I, had been a captain in the engineers corps, and he was talking about putting pontoon bridge across the Rhine, and he kept saying in his talk, well, putting the bridge across the Rhine was like crossing the Delaware, crossing the Delaware. He couldn't come up with Washington.
Oh, no.
You know, on the spur of the moment of, you know, and so here that sticks in my mind. Yeah, about
panic of having to give a speech.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, you know, you get hit with a blank, that is like everything we know, right? But another, but that, I don't know whether, how much I did during the junior, but I know I did a lot during the senior. I had a good friend, his name was Paul Fenske, and his father was president of that Lutheran Academy. And he's a little older than I.
The tape is just a... Okay.
And Paul was a little older than I. And let's see, when I was in the sixth grade, he may have been in the eighth grade. And before I did any working in the summer and stuff, I remember his teaching me how to spoke a bike, and I took a bicycle I had and took all the spokes off and redid it and redid the brakes on it, you know, completely. You know, I was maybe 11 or something, so you know, I learned quite a bit from him, as I said, his father was the president of this academy, but he got in the army. Being, you know, I was young enough, fortunately, to miss it. And when he came out, he went to School of Mines, and so majoring in geology. But we went out a lot of weekends, on say Sundays, hiking in the hills, and visit a lot of these old mines, you know, down around what's that little town next to the
Custer?
Rushmore.
Custer?
No, this side.
Keystone.
Keystone, right around Keystone, and all sorts of. I remember climbing up the Etta Mine. You know, that used to have the biggest spodumene crystals ever seen in the world, there were a lot of pegmatite mines back there, and he and I'd go in the mills, and I got a few mineral specimens that one could find or in the dumps and so on, you know, some of you probably ran all of those old mines. You did the oral history of
A.I. Johnson.
You know, I think, you know, he he ran a lot of those and lived there, as you well know. But anyway, Paul and I did much of that, and we did a lot of, and I think that's what moved me more towards the mineral processing side of metallurgy, other than the the physical metallurgy or the high temperature metallurgy. It was just that I got very interested in minerals.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that was done that way.
Right.
And in fact, I used to hike around quite often, still in high school, with last year there with my friend Frank Marion. And I'll tell you, one time we went down to Rushmore and just started hiking up. And this was late winter or early spring, and we hiked up Rushmore, and all of a sudden came around a tree or a rock, and there was the back head of Washington's head. We were we climbed up on top, and not supposed to do that.
No.
And I have a few pictures taken up there. Anyway, Paul Fenske and I later, and I think my brother Maury, who then was, just high school.
Mm-hmm.
Three of us hiked up the same route. We come up the front on the right and on up to the top
of
Mount Rushmore. Again, that was, I think, very early spring. There was probably no tourists down there. They didn't come at us. But I did that many, many weekends with Paul Fenske, as I recall, the year being more or less uneventful, my sophomore year, I really studied very hard and had all A's, even though I was taking 22 units. But when I went to Chicago, I got a little more relaxed, and so I didn't work like that, and spent Saturday nights enjoying oneself and so on. So my grades weren't as junior, senior, what they were as sophomore. But I decided as graduation approached, I had this. Without applying, I had this offer, to come to work at U.S. Steel. But I decided to go on to graduate school, so I applied five different places, of which they all accepted me and offered me fellowship.
Did South Dakota Gold Mines have any graduate?
They probably had, you could do a master's there, I assume, but that didn't.
That was all.
That didn't occur to me. But I applied to MIT, and they wanted a course in petrography or something like that, which I hadn't had, and so I actually got the geology professor, because it was out of sequence, so he actually taught a sort of one-on-one course. It was probably me more working with a microscope in the lab to get credit for this course in petrography or petrology or something. But I applied to Montana School of Mines. My friend Frank Applin, who I didn't know too well in South Dakota, but a bit. He was, of course, was quite a few years older than I am, but he'd been a senior in metallurgy. He'd gone to Butte, so I applied to Montana School of Mines, University of Utah, Missouri School of Mines, I think University of Nevada. I just looked at various places, and and decided, and I don't know why, I think it was a good thing I did, but I decided to go to Butte and turned all the others down, including MIT, and I didn't find out till later that apparently the letters, of course, related to MIT somehow crossed in the mail, and this guy Spedden, who was charge of the mineral processing graduate program, he was not going to have anything to do with me, I learned, when I reapplied.
Because you turned them down?
That turned them down the first time. Mm-hmm. I'll come back to that. But I have a little bit of a thought that you know, I don't know whether that hit you or not. When you come from a small town, although Rapid City is a big city, a small environment, you're kind of afraid of the big time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether that entered my decision not to go to MIT at that time or not, or whether I just thought, well, let me go here. But I've seen that in students. There are a lot of them that I've seen through the years, if they come from a small place, a lot of them, you know, they get a BS from South Dakota, go back, get a master's from there, or they get a BS from Butte, and they stay there and get a master's, when they should not. They should go somewhere else. And that may have entered into my thinking, and I'll touch on when I did get to MIT, how things went. For example, I worked in high school, and they used to put on the list of who had 5 A's, 4 A's, 3 A's. I had 5 A's always. And there was somebody, his name was Joe Sukash, and I, funny name, he had 5 A's, and he was somebody very active in all sorts of things. And he went to Cornell, and I later saw that this English lit teacher was a Cornell graduate. I now have, when I spotted that in the old yearbook, she probably arranged for him to get. Mm-hmm. He got a scholarship to go to Cornell, big thing in the Rapid City paper. And after a year, he quit. You know,
overwhelmed.
That's what I'm thinking. He's probably overwhelmed, and somebody I didn't know other than what I knew. What he looked, he was, you know, a year ahead. But he and I were the two in the school that always had, you know, the 5 A's. But I think he was overwhelmed, I don't know whether you had that attitude or not, but that's what gave me the decision to go to Butte. But then in the spring, I don't know if somebody came by or whether there just was a letter that came to the let me back up. What I did have was Dr. Lincoln had died and became a new mining professor at South Dakota named Lyle Schaefer. And Schaefer, I really was impressed with Schaefer. And I took I'm trying to think whether he finished a course that I had started with Lincoln. I don't know. But anyway, I did take a course that he talked on mineral economics, mine economics, and was really impressed with him. And thought he'd come from Missouri School of Mines, I mean, where he'd been on the faculty. And made a big impression on me, and I interacted with him a fair amount. And we'll get to him later, because he became well acquainted with Don McLaughlin, and probably somehow through Homestate, and he came here to Berkeley. And he really is responsible for my coming here, I think, and although he became a problem here. We'll come to that. But Schaefer did enter into my life in a significant way, I think. And so as a senior, I'd had this course. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Bunker Hill had openings for about 250 summer students.
Bunker Hill Mining.
Bunker Hill and Sullivan Mining and Smelting Company in Kellogg, Idaho. And so I got a job there. I must have done it by letter. I can't imagine they went around and maybe one other from South Dakota and two other of my classmates, either same year or a year later, decided, well, they would drive out and see if they could get a job. In other words, they hadn't gotten a letter saying that there was a job, but they maybe didn't start early enough. And so anyway, I got this summer job, and we drove out and drove through Yellowstone Park. And you know, we went there, I think, about the very first day Yellowstone was open. Mm-hmm. And there were three or four of us, and he had an old, well, in those days probably wasn't old, but like a 47 or 48 Chevrolet two-door car. I think it was just two doors. But anyway, I think there were four of us, and anyway, we slept that night in Yellowstone Park in the car, and I'll tell you that hard to go. But I still remember waking up early in the morning, it was just getting light, and of course the windows were kind of fogged over, and wiping it off, and there was a moose looking right in the window. and we drove on to Kellogg, and those two never got a job. In other words, they had so many, well, they'd filled them. What they did was in the summer, apparently, a lot of the miners and the people in the mills and smelters lumbered or farmed in the summer. Mm-hmm. And we were told that, and so they hired college students as fill-in. Mm. And so my job was in the lead smelter. And now you read so much about lead. And of course, you know, Bunker Hill always makes the paper today yet about their tailings and so on. But my job was in the lead smelter, in lead smelting, they take the galena concentrate which is lead sulfide, and you roast it, burn it, and make lead oxide. And then that lead oxide is charged to a blast furnace where you have coke, and the coke reacts with the oxygen, and out comes the lead. And so it's the same thing as an iron blast furnace, but much lower temperature. Etc. Let me back up one step, because that to this maybe the spring of 48, when Applin was still around, because Applin and I did a lot of summer trips that summer in Idaho. But one time in the spring, we went up to Homestake, Frank and I, and to see the mill. So we went in, and the person we went to see was your father. I still remember he first, you know, discussed the flow sheet a bit, talked to us a bit, and then I assume passed us on to junior engineer of some sort, whoever may have been junior back then, but I, mm-hmm. I still remember your father in a white shirt and a necktie, and I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't a black suit, you know?
Oh, a suit for sure.
Yeah, isn't it, you know, to, I know what they dress like today, but
it was different.
But Frank and I had a complete thorough tour, and that's when they still had the stamp mills running.
Mm, you know? Really?
Oh yeah, those stamps were stamping away, and you know, it must have been the largest remnant stamp mill there was. And that was, you know, again, one of the kind of tourings that I told you about that went on. Anyway, I'll come back to it. But my job then in Bunker Hill was the, they called it the sinter, which came out of the roasting plant. Was loaded into charge cars that would then dump that cinder into the top of the lead blast furnace, and my job was to load those charge cars.
Oh.
And you know, all I had on was kind of a, well, probably a kind of heavy work clothes of some sort, and a simple mask, and I mean simple. Mm-hmm. And well, maybe you had a rope tied around your gloves and so on to keep it out. But for years, the pores in my legs were black, you know, and I think that was lead, black from lead, the lead oxide. And I'm still alive, so.
Oh, but that was...
But that's really, it amazes me what working around a lead smelter was like in 1949. Mm. Because at Homestake, I visited the smelter, Herculaneum smelter there on south of St. Louis. You'd think we were going, we were in outfits that you thought we were landing on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, completely encased helmets, and the suits we had on were looked like moon suits compared to what 1949 was what I'm telling about. And so I did this again. This was shift work.
So you said your legs got the major exposure.
Well, the pores in my legs, just the dust, and this was lead dust, lead oxide.
Right.
They were those pores were black for years, and my guess is that was lead oxide from the.
Must have been.
And maybe that's why I got. I think heredity made me lose my hair now. But anyway, then.
Well, was there any awareness at that time of the dangers of lead?
Apparently not. Apparently not. Because, how much, I know a lot of the time was just spent, you know, pulling a big lever to fill these sort of cars about the size of small mine cars with, and you know, this dust pour out because it's roasted lead oxide, and then those cars are then dumped in the top of the lead blast furnace. And now I don't remember whether I had to move the cars or whether somebody else did. But I then later on was working in the floor of the lead smelter itself at times, and you know they're pouring the molten lead as it comes out, and over 50 feet away are big vats where they're removing impurities from liquid lead, you know, so the fumes, and they're probably just big fans ventilating the system. I'm assuming that's really all there was. But what happened later in the summer was a strike. And the strike shut down everything. And only a few of us had a job, which was go into the lead blast furnace with a jackhammer and dig out the charge. And I was one of them. I mean, you know, it was cooled down, of course, but go in there with a jackhammer and dig out this something between lead and lead oxide and coke. And
what kind of protective clothing did you
have? It was, I probably just had a simple nothing dust mask. You know, I mean nothing fancy.
Hard hat?
Oh, one always would have a hard hat. Yeah, I think even the steel mills, I think everybody always wore that, and safety shoes. That was the one bit of safety that all of these companies seemed to have, was you have steel-toed shoes and you had a hat and safety glasses. But the real thing, I think, was this atmosphere business of nothing more than a respiratory mask.
The Selby smelter, I just happened to look up the other day, it closed in 70. It was closed down.
Well, I went through there once, so, but have no recollection of what.
So by then there was real awareness of the hazards of lead.
Well, the tailings up at, I'm not talking about the smelter tailings, but the mill tailings at Bunker Hill, you know, we've read about those several years ago. The dust would blow, and the kids had a schoolyard apparently right nearby, and so children were getting affected by lead poisoning in Kellogg. That made national papers, well, for somebody having that kind of exposure to lead, I don't know that that it, I assume, had no lasting effect on me. Maybe
must,
it did. Maybe it'd have been better if I hadn't.
But you think of people that were working there in the 30s, 40s, all those years, they must have had a lot of exposure.
True. And you know, there were people worked to retirement.
Sure. Those mines were open long, early in the century, weren't they?
Oh yeah. It
maybe
before
even in the
1800s. I think they started in either 1900 or 1890 or
so
on. Anyway, as I said, you know, there were about 250. Different summer students there, and I got to know.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and I got to know several. They came from all over. I remember they were from University of Washington, were two Turks, and there was somebody that I was friends with for quite a few years, came from Seattle, named Stair Dickerman, and he, because of what my influence on him, he that fall decided he'd go to be an undergrad he's older than I am a little bit, but at Montana School of Mines. And then I remember at lunch one day, we lived in a dormitory there, where they had, I suppose, for single workers, all mining, big mining places used to have those, and we had ate our meals there, and I suppose they provided, well, they must have provided lunches for.
Is it called a dormitory?
Or what would be another word?
Bunkhouse.
Bunkhouse wasn't quite right. No. It may have been almost called dormitory.
Maybe it was.
Because it was looked like several buildings.
Staff house?
Well, we weren't staff.
We weren't staff.
But anyway, one person that I was friends with for many, many years, was this young guy all of a sudden had there with both arms completely wrapped up. And he had been a freshman at Montana School of Mines, Jack Jordan, and he'd fallen, he was working in the mine, and he'd fallen down some kind of shaft and broken both arms. My acquaintance with him went on for many years, and I don't know who was with or how I got there, but one Saturday afternoon, I think it was an afternoon, drove over to Mullen, Idaho, and we're in the bar having a beer, and sitting on the bar stool was my friend Frank Acklin, and he was working that summer for Hecla, I think in the Star Mine, there in Mullen, I think right in Mullen. So Frank had a car, and then practically every Saturday that each of us were free after that, we visited many of the mines and actually mills in the whole area, including, for example, the Morning Mill. Now the Morning Mine was one of the famous old mines that does date back to 1880 or 90. Even when it quit, there's still fairly high grade lead, but apparently it was deep, you know, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 feet in the ground there wouldn't take, you know, home state, they can get down that deep, and it's good hard rock. But that apparently the ground just, what the miners would call the ground, wouldn't hold, so they just couldn't go any deeper. But the mill had equipment in it that dated back to the turn of the century, wow, which was interesting to see. I mean, that's what they were using. But we visited the Sunshine Mine, you know, that's one of the major
just
silver
closed.
Producers. Did that close now?
Just recently, I think.
Yeah, okay. That, you know, is always one of the silver mines. Almost every Saturday we went to a different one, and including the Bunker Hill Mill, which was for the region, was a big one. And I still remember an old mill operator that, you know, it was a little bit noisy, and we were looking at the ball mill, and this operator comes up and says, this here is a one of them there ball mills who grinds up that there ore. But that was a big operation. You know, they also had a zinc plant, too, there. Zinc plant, lead smelter. You know, I think the major owners were Bradley's, weren't they, of Bunker Hill? I didn't know any of that then, of course.
Fred Bradley made his name at that place, I think.
Oh, yeah, and was president of it. Because you know, they lived here. But, you know, he and his wife were killed in a car accident on a Thanksgiving. It was in the newspaper.
Son.
What?
His son.
That son was, was the one then head of, at that time, head of,
right,
of Bunker Hill. So we're now, okay, you know more about that history than I do.
And Boston Money, I think.
Oh, is that right?
That's why the Bunker Hill name.
You know, I didn't know that. I knew they had Boston Money and copper, but also in lead.
And I think this too.
Hey, I'll back up to another one of the funny little stories. Was some metallurgy classmate there in South Dakota said one day, we played hearts. I remember a bunch of us every noon at lunchtime.
What time? Poker?
Hearts.
Hearts.
Hearts. You know, that's that game that maybe Maslach told me about.
Yes.
An ongoing hearts game in the faculty club for generations.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were playing bridge over there, and here it was none but hearts. Anyway, he said he was walking down the street there on St. Joe or Main Street in Rapid City, and somebody got out of his car and walked up to him and said, "Where are them Hades?"
What?
And he looked at him, "Where are them Hades? Well, you know, the Hades up on the mountain." He was from Kentucky, the Heads.
Oh.
Oh, Rushmore. Where are the Hades?
Oh, dear.
summer, then, you know, Frank.